Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, How They Mined Loyalty, Traditions, and Profit. Triangle's century-old companies have endured and thrived despite massive changes in the way the world conducts business. And that's the headline on the cover, but then inside the Triangle Business Journal, the article begins with a second headline. Triangle Companies with 100-Year Staying Power, How the Region's Oldest Businesses Have Sustained Their Cultures in the Modern World. And this article is written by Cameron Snipes. It's unlikely that any of these Triangle companies will be listed in the ever-popular Best Places to Work rankings conducted by national publications. That's because they are primarily small businesses, they operate out of a single facility, and these outfits have rarely sought out global glory. Yet, they have been in business for more than 100 years and are cloaked with loyalties and traditions that are passed down through several generations. Take, for instance, the story of 97-year-old Edward Curtis, who since the end of World War II has worked at Raleigh's Alfred Williams & Company, an office furniture dealer founded 148 years ago. Curtis, for most of his career, has worked as a driver, traveling to client sites to lend his expertise to complex furniture installations. 2 years ago, Blunt Williams, chairman and CEO of the company, noticed that Curtis was beginning to show his age with regard to his work. Williams sat down with Curtis's daughter to discuss his ongoing employment. I didn't want to quit work, says Curtis, who has worked for the Alfred Williams family since 1935. The company now gives him a handful of cash every Monday morning for cab rides to and from work. He works 3 days per week and is paid the same hourly wage as he did when he worked full-time at the company. He's our storyteller, Williams says. The employer-employee relationship at Williams' company, and all others that have survived two world wars, one catastrophic depression, and countless recessions, reflect a culture of interdependence that is rarely prevalent in business today. In an era where companies are born, sold, and closed within months, and the term fast fail has become an endearing notion in boardrooms of investor groups, it is hard to imagine the survival tactics of these more than 100-year-old businesses sprinkled around the Raleigh-Durham metropolitan area. An analysis of the state's incorporations data and Triangle Business Journal research shows that out of 146 entities in the Triangle area that filed for incorporation in North Carolina from 1900, the earliest year the state has records, through the end of March 1915, just north of 20 companies remain alive today. What may be less of a surprise is that many of them are still owned by the families that started each one. Fast pivot. These companies today operate in industries from garden centers to commercial printing, from the office furniture business to optometry. And as Williams explains, the job does not get easier despite the longevity, reputation, and familiarity. Williams began his career at the company in 1981. Ups and downs came, just as in any business. But on July 1, 2008, everything changed. Williams made the decision to purchase office furniture dealerships in South Carolina and decided to merge with the dealership in Charlotte. But the latest recession played havoc with Williams's company. The year 2009 was a really, really tough time for us, Williams says. Overburdened, the company went from 350 employees to 150 and saw its revenue slashed by 50% over a 16-month period. We had to make some tough decisions, he admits. As a result, Williams changed the company model, reduced overhead, and outsourced its installation services. We have to reinvent ourselves every day, Williams professes, adding that the company has now climbed back to about 195 workers. Needless to say, most of these companies, especially the ones that make and sell products, have more competition from all corners of the world. Margins are disappearing from these companies' P&L statements, and some owners are getting frustrated with the lack of growth and progress. So, is there a secret ingredient in the enduring company recipe, or is it just all about the bottom line? Jim Lee, a family business expert and professor at UNC Chapel Hill, points to the culture and the unified goal of these companies. They don't spend more than they earn, Lee notes, adding these companies are ready and willing to respond to, even anticipate, change. To them, the most important thing is to preserve the business, he adds. Ownership change. Some companies go through several ownership changes but survive by remaining solidly focused on their core business and audience. Diversity is necessary in order to keep up with the ever-growing number of outside forces that crop up within a business's lifespan. Whether it's increased competition, technological advances, or the fact that the mom-and-pop proprietor's only offspring has no interest in taking over, centenarian businesses have been able to adapt while keeping in mind the reason why they started the business. To Dale Harrison, president of Jones Printing Company in Sanford, it's been mostly about adapting to those technological advances. He says his customers now, who range from walk-in clients wanting wedding invitations to commercial entities needing instructional catalogs, want higher quality products and fast. Since 2007, when the company swelled to its peak, it has experienced roughly a 45% reduction in staff from 19 employees to 12. People have their own personal printers now, Harrison says, who adds that more digital presses have been added for faster churn, particularly for the smaller jobs, a big part of its business. We've had to keep up with the times. Being focused on the core business, knowing the audience, keeping a close eye on the bottom line, preserving traditions. While there are other things that affect success in business, and certainly not every long-standing business stays in the family, those are key areas. I have found that companies that last 100 years or longer have a particular mantra that they follow, whether it be treating their employees with the utmost respect, and that flows through to the customers, vendors, and community. Giving back to the community or creating a work-family atmosphere at work, says Rhonda Stokes, interim director of Wake Forest University Family Business Center. Also, family-run businesses, unlike for-profit businesses, make decisions for the long haul, not next quarter profits. Most long-standing companies have hit the century mark by careful planning and consideration of the next iterations of their legacies. But even among family businesses, only 30% make it to the second generation, and only a third of those survive to the third, according to family business publication TheraWatt. But once in a while, those things are so ingrained in the minds of a company's owner that it just comes naturally. Consider Durham's Rothstein Vision Center, now helmed by third-generation optometrist Dr. Robert Rosenstein. Rosenstein Vision Center. There was no succession plan, he says. That was just the way it happened. Rosenstein Vision Center, founded in Durham in 1904 by Dr. Nathan Rosenstein, almost didn't make it past the second generation. My father encouraged me to be a dentist, Rosenstein says, but the profession of optometry ultimately appealed to him more, so he continued in the family practice and took over after his father died in 1974. And as for its longevity over the years, Rosenstein says it's about the people that pay you for your service and being willing to make sacrifices along the way. So what's the plan for the practice going forward? True to form, no succession plan is currently in place. 35-year-old Aaron, who practices alongside his father, has no children, but Rosenstein does have 6 grandchildren by his 2 daughters. I'm not going to pressure them, Robert Rosenstein says. Someone's going to be the last. I just want them to be happy. That ingrained loyalty is something that a lot of 100-plus-year-old companies must rely on. While these businesses obviously need to focus on the numbers to remain viable, traditions are passed on through people, and it's through those people that these stories are told. I've seen the company change from a small outfit to a big outfit, Curtis says. When Blunt Williams' daddy had it, they had a little meeting here, a little meeting there. When Blunt Williams took it over, he put the business in the big time. And along with this article, there are blurbs on each company, and we'll read off just the list of the company that's called the Centennial Club, a look at local businesses that are more than 100 years old, Brownwin Funeral Home, Alfred Williams & Company, Rosenstein Vision Center, Mechanics and Farmers Bank, M&F Bancorp Incorporated, Scarborough and Hargett Funeral Home Incorporated, Jones Printing Company Incorporated, Carolina Country Club, McDonald York Building Company, Commercial Printing Company, Pinehurst Resort and Country Club, York Properties Incorporated, Person Street Pharmacy, North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, First Citizens Bank, Smith Anderson, Four Oaks Bank, Store Office Environments, Stone Brothers and Bird, Dillon Supply Company, and North Carolina Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by Managing Editor Rebecca Troyer. The first headline, New Owners Want Bar to Be Like Cheers. Some people want to play lots of golf in retirement. Others want to move to the beach or the mountains. Marilyn and Mike Allard wanted to run a restaurant. The couple took over ownership of Leesville Tap Room and say that, despite the work, they couldn't be happier. My husband and I had wanted to buy a restaurant, or actually were looking more for a sports bar, says Marilyn Allard, who worked in accounting and real estate in her former life. It's an exciting venture for us. The couple had been planning for this for more than a few years. Allard says that when they would travel, they would always check out various sports bars and restaurants for new ideas and slowly compiled a long list of things they liked and didn't like. It was kind of a lifelong dream, she says. Even though they weren't on the doorstep of retirement just yet, the opportunity presented itself and they took it. The Allard story will be familiar to many who grew up in Raleigh. She attended Appalachian State University. He went to NC State University, and they moved back to North Raleigh in 1986. Their sons played baseball and football and attended Sanderson High School and Appalachian. Marilyn Allard says that one of her favorite things about the restaurant, while which they are calling the new LTR, is the community feel. Opened in 2008, the eatery already has a good crowd of locals who frequently stop in, and the Allards only hope to make it more cozy. It's a community bar. It's kind of like Cheers, Allard says. Wanted, new building plan. North Carolina's state budget director, Lee Roberts, has for much of his career in the fields of finance, Morgan Stanley in New York City, Vantage South Bank in Midtown Raleigh, worked out of office buildings, mostly nice Class A office buildings. While his new state office on the fifth floor above Jones Street has a great view of downtown Raleigh and is within easy walking distance of the governor's office and the General Assembly leaders, it doesn't offer much atmosphere or efficiency. Roberts told Biz that he hopes to change that, starting with the big $2.4 billion bond proposal for infrastructure and highway improvements that was unveiled April 16. But beyond the renovations and patchwork that could be covered by the bonds, Robert says there are plenty more ways the state can save money by better managing its real estate. Take the administration building that he and the governor share on Jones Street. It needs a new roof, he says, which would be the third roof replacement since it was built in the late 1960s. Is it a good use of taxpayer money to put a third roof on this building? He asks. Or should we be partnering with the private sector to occupy office space under a long-term lease arrangement that would be more efficient and save money? We need to put state-owned buildings to a higher and better use. Raleigh exec named honorary consul of Canada. Scott Cutler, vice president of Clancy and Thays Construction Company, has a new title, honorary consul of Canada in Raleigh. The appointment was announced April 15 by Louise Blaise, Consul General of Canada for the Southeastern United States. He will play a key role in advancing Canadian interests in Raleigh by facilitating relationships between business, elected, and community leaders in North Carolina's Raleigh area and Canada, Blaise says. Canada is North Carolina's largest foreign trade partner, with bilateral trade totaling $10.2 billion in 2014. Exchanges between North Carolina and Canada have exceeded $10 billion in each of the last 3 years, and Canada buys nearly 22% of North Carolina's exports, making it the state's top international customer. Additionally, trade with Canada is responsible for about 250,000 North Carolina jobs. The announcement cites several Canadian companies as having operations in the Triangle, specifically mentioning Salix, which was just purchased by Canadian firm Valiant. And in a section headlined The Hype, Triangle communities make headlines in recent national rankings. Number one, Raleigh earns the top rank overall on a list of the top mid-sized U.S. cities of the future. That's from FDI Intelligence, a division of Financial Times. Number two, Raleigh is the second best city for tech job creation, according to Forbes. Number three, Raleigh is number three in the U.S. for overall well-being, according to Gallup Healthways. Number 12, Durham-Chapel Hill Metro has 12th best southern job market, according to Zip Recruiter. Number 13, Raleigh is the 13th most literate U.S. city, Central Connecticut University annual study. Number 14, Raleigh is the 14th best U.S. market for tech talent, CBRE. And number 19, Durham ranks among top 20 of America's greenest cities, from Nerd Wallet. And in a section called Head Turner, she's looking for a job in a very big way. Carrie Peel, former owner of Raleigh-based Blue Diamond Worldwide Transportation, decided on an unusual approach to finding a new leadership position after she sold her company in 2014. She rented a billboard at the intersection of Highway 401 and I-440 in Raleigh. I've always been someone who marketed to the masses, so why not use that same approach in my search for a job, says Peel. And the billboard says, for top-line growth and bottom-line results, hire me, with arrows pointing to carriepeel.com and a large picture of Carrie Peel. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal, beginning with On Real Estate by Amanda Hoyle. Why Kipdell Homes is selling its ITB properties. Carl G. Kip Young and his sister, Jenny Kelling, are working to forward the legacy of Kipdell Homes, the Raleigh residential rental property firm that their father had founded nearly 60 years ago, and that they inherited upon his death in 2011. Over the past 14 months, sold more than 170 of Kipdell Homes' single and multifamily properties that their father and other family members had amassed mostly in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, rental units that have provided affordable housing options for working professionals wanting to live near downtown Raleigh. It's been apparent, especially for properties inside the Beltline, that there's a considerable appetite among home builders and developers for this land, Young says. We decided we'd rather be investing that money in apartments. Altogether, the family-owned Kipdell Homes Company has gained close to $16 million from all of its property sales, from mostly within the Interstate 440 Beltline, since January 2014, according to a review of Way County deed records. Their latest transaction, the $6.6 million sale of the 71-unit Brookview duplex community off of Person Street near downtown Raleigh, is their largest property sale yet. But in October 2014, Kipdell Homes also made its largest acquisition in company history with the $21 million purchase of the Pine Winds community, a 216-unit apartment complex off of U.S. 401 in South Raleigh. Young says with these recent property sales, he, Kelling, and Kelling's daughter, Geneva Hines, who has also joined the company, are looking for other potential apartment communities in which to invest in the Triangle. In the By the Numbers section, the headline, Triangle Home Sales, March. Real estate agents and home sellers across the Triangle grabbed the rebound in March as home sales improved nearly 19% compared to 1 year ago and posted a more than 49% jump from February's adjusted home sales total. Home sales for the first quarter 2015 were up 8% following a slow start for the year in January and February, according to Triangle Multiple Listing Service. March had the highest month of home sales of the past 7 months in the Triangle. And in hotel news, Crabtree Marriott plans major renovation. The owners of the Raleigh Marriott Crabtree Valley Hotel, Rockbridge Partners, and its hotel management group, Concord Hospitality Enterprises of Raleigh, are kicking off a major renovation of the Midtown Raleigh Hotel that will double the size of its conference center for events, renovate all of its guest rooms, and relocate the property's patio and pool areas to a new space by this time next year. Hotel General Manager Dan Freeland says construction work has already begun around the hotel's former indoor-outdoor swimming pool area, which will soon become part of its expanded meeting room spaces. The hotel currently has about 10,000 square feet of event space that will double to 20,000 square feet. The new pool and patio area will be built near the entrance into the hotel. The renovations should be completed by early 2016. And in the Triangle Business Journal, turning to the On Healthcare page, written by Jason DeBrun, the first headline, Roper, it's not boring. UNC Healthcare CEO on Healthcare and Politics. UNC Healthcare CEO Dr. Bill Roper was recognized by Modern Healthcare as one of the 50 most influential physician executives and leaders. He ranked number 31 on the list. In addition to being CEO of UNC Healthcare, Roper is also Dean of the UNC School of Medicine and Vice Chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill. Earlier in his career, Roper was Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, served on the senior White House staff, and was Administrator of the Healthcare Financing Administration, responsible for Medicare and Medicaid. Where do you think you have had the most influence in healthcare? I'd say that my current position, Dean of UNC School of Medicine and CEO of UNC Healthcare, is the one that has the most opportunity for influence and impact. My time in senior federal government jobs at the White House, Medicare and Medicaid, and the CDC was very interesting and enjoyable, but what I'm doing now is firmly rooted in the actual front lines of medical education, biomedical research, and healthcare delivery, and I really feel fortunate to be doing what I'm doing right now. The North Carolina General Assembly will take up several high-profile healthcare bills this summer. What role do you see yourself playing in the discussion? Our legislature is actively considering several far-reaching health issues, including Medicaid, mental health, and CON, Certificate of Need, reform. We are working in concert with other colleagues from across the state, to be sure, but I am also spending a fair amount of time in Raleigh, visiting with legislators, explaining to them what the real-world impact their proposals will have, and giving them what I hope is constructive suggestions. Some see this summer as being one in which lawmakers could drastically change how health care is provided in North Carolina. Do you agree? We are living right now in a time of very great change in healthcare in our state and nation. The four-year med school and teaching hospital in Chapel Hill opened more than 60 years ago, but I think we will see more change in the next few years than in those 60-plus years past. While the work of the legislature is very important, and we pay a lot of attention to it, I believe that the major force for change now is not government, but the private sector and citizens at large. I believe what has just happened is that the American people have decided that health care is just too expensive and that we do not do enough to make it safe and effective. We have to change to respond to that push from the public. You carry influence in health care. Where do you turn for guidance, advice, counsel? I count it a blessing to get to do what I do. I get to work on consequential issues with bright, committed people. Here and elsewhere, people care deeply about what we do. I regularly tell people, it's not boring, in response to their questions about how I'm doing. My best advisor is my wife. She keeps me grounded. And in a section on pharmaceuticals, Chinese investor buys $10 million in shares of Argos Therapeutics. A Chinese investment group bought $10 million in shares of a Durham company that is developing a therapy that might help cancer patients fight their own cancers. In return, the Durham company licensed the therapy to the Chinese company and could receive up to $20 million in milestones and sell the investor another $10 million in shares. Durham-based Argos Therapeutics is developing a platform called Arcellus that, if approved, would take RNA from a cancer patient's tumor, analyze it at its labs, tailor a treatment, and then use its technology to train a patient's own body to fight the cancer. This would be accomplished specifically by using a patient's own dendritic cells and tumor sample to create a fully personalized immunotherapy. Argos reached the deal with Lummi Company Limited, Hong Kong, a wholly owned subsidiary of Chongqing Lummi Pharmaceutical Company Limited. Under the terms of the agreement, Lummi HK will license from Argos the rights to manufacture, develop, and commercialize AGS-003, Argos's investigational immunotherapy for the treatment of cancer, in China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Macau. And finally, in the legislative corner, tax change could gouge nonprofits. North Carolina organizations that file as nonprofits, hospitals in particular, are nervous that a tax change being considered by lawmakers could significantly cut into their revenue. The short title of Senate Bill 700 cuts right to the chase: limit sales tax refund for nonprofits. At a fundamental level, North Carolina tax policy maintains that organizations that qualify as nonprofits provide a public good and should therefore receive a tax benefit. Hospitals are generally the largest organizations by far that file as nonprofits, so the majority of the benefit goes to them. For the 2012 to 2013 fiscal year, that benefit totaled $285 million in North Carolina. Of that total, hospitals received the most benefit, 80%. Educational institutions, including private colleges and K-12 schools, received another 12%. Those percentages have held roughly consistent through the years, according to the Department of Revenue. And the first headline in the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onisorge: Lenovo unveils new brand at global meeting in Raleigh. Lenovo CEO Yang King Yang told the 5,000 Lenovo employees at PNC Arena that it's a critical time for the Chinese electronics company. Speaking at the firm's annual kickoff meeting in Raleigh on April 14, he told employees that the opportunity to make market share gains across all platforms is upon them. A consolidating PC industry provides the opportunity for the attack part of his often touted protect and attack strategy, he says. As the competition narrows its focus, such as HP's decision to spin out its PC and printer business to focus on other technologies, Lenovo is doing the opposite. It's looking at ways to engage, or as Yang likes to call it, attack, on multiple platforms. Lenovo, which reiterated its top PC standing last week via IDC's latest research report, is changing. Tuesday marked the debut of the new logo, a logo execs say represent exactly what Yang is talking about, transformation. Previously, the red letters spelling out the name of the Chinese computer maker were italic and lowercase with a static black background, no more. Lenovo today is not the same company we were 5 years ago or even 6 months ago, said Chief Marketing Officer David Roman to applause. We want to look different. We want a new logo, a new look to reflect who we have become. On the screen behind him, the Lenovo letters, no longer slanted, flashed in front of a variety of backgrounds as the crowd cheered. Our new logo is as dynamic as it is diverse, he said. And it's difficult to understand, mostly because it's not a single logo. It's a template to which multiple colors and backgrounds, everything from fireworks to crowd scenes, can be applied in the negative space around the letters. That's because, according to Roman, Lenovo is pushing customer engagement and personalization, and that's reflected in a customizable logo, meant to be as flexible as execs on stage. And competition is high, particularly in the United States. While the firm, according to IDC, has 19.6% of the global PC market share, it owns 11.8% of the stake in the U.S. Lenovo is the third-place PC player in the United States after HP and Dell. The company, which houses its North American headquarters and enterprise group in the Triangle, has about 3,500 employees in the Triangle, the majority of whom were among the 5,000-plus at PNC Arena on April 14. Citrix CEO disappointed with Q1 revenue results. Mark Templeton, CEO of Citrix, announced that when its earnings come out April 22, the software developer will miss its revenue target. The Florida-based company, which just built a massive new campus in Raleigh's warehouse district, expects revenue in the range of $755 million to $760 million, below a previous guidance of $780 to $790 million. Templeton says the company underestimated the impact of a recent restructuring plan, which contributes to the miss. It's not the first time Templeton has released a statement like this. What he said this month: "We are disappointed with our Q1 results, but fully committed to the financial, operational, and strategic initiatives announced last quarter." What he said in October about a $20 million revenue miss: "While we are disappointed that we fell short of our expectations this quarter, we remain confident in our strategy and markets." And in a section called New Products: In Your Face with New Smartphone Device. Carry entrepreneur David Smith wants you to wear your smartphone on your face when you fly, like your own personal IMAX, he says, adding that the prototype has become a regular part of his passenger routine. His invention is a lens device that, like glasses, can be worn right in front of your eyes. All you have to do is slip in your smartphone and turn on your favorite game or movie. The prototype gives him a 150-degree field of view when he wears the lenses. He says, for perspective, an IMAX screen gives 110. With his Carry startup, Wearality, Smith, a co-founder of Tom Clancy Focus Studio, Red Storm Entertainment, wants to turn your smartphone into a virtual reality headset, a $50 device that fits into your pocket. He's spinning the technology out of Lockheed Martin, the defense contractor that bought another of Smith's startups, 3D Solve, in 2007. According to securities filings, the firm is trying to raise $3 million in a debt round and has raised about $1 million from six investors. Smith's next stop is Kickstarter, where he's trying to raise $100,000. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the executive voice, and this one is concerning Ryan Conklin. And a closer look: name, Ryan Conklin, title, executive chef at Rex Healthcare, number of employees, 95, family, wife, Heather, son, Aiden, 9, daughter, Kira, 4, education, the Culinary Institute of America, Hyde Park, New York, first job, dishwasher at Senior Executive Conference Center at Columbia University, New York. And the headline on his question and answer: Rex chef shares the healing art of good food, hospital check-in not required. And this is written by Dathan Kazuk. 16 chefs participated in the Got to Be North Carolina Competition Dining Series, Triangle Edition 2015. Included in the lineup were such notable chefs as Shane Ingram from Durham's Four Square Restaurant and Chef Jerry Fong from New Bern, who appeared in an episode of Food Network's Cutthroat Kitchen. Also included among this prestigious group was a hospital chef, Chef Ryan Conklin, executive chef at Rex Healthcare in Raleigh, who ended up winning the competition. Conklin's Cuisine recently landed Rex on Condé Nast Traveler's List of 9 great meals in unexpected places. In his kitchen in Rex, Conklin shares details about his journey and why he chose healthcare as a backdrop for his talents. How did you get involved in the world of cuisine? I started out as a pot washer, but my first real job was at the Executive Conference Center in New York for Columbia University. I would get my job done so quick that the chefs would actually let me do their dirty work, like peeling shrimp and chopping parsley. The people I was serving were CEOs and executives from across the country who would come to Columbia University. Slowly, the chefs would have me do things like making cold cut platters and garnishes. From there, did you go to train full-time? I went to the Culinary Institute of America. After school, I worked for the Four Seasons Hotel in Manhattan. A friend I went to school with was working in Ireland at the time, and I'm from an Irish background, and an opportunity for me to go over there came up, so I jumped on it. I was 21 at the time, so it was a great opportunity. I came back and worked in restaurants in New York's Hudson Valley region and became a sous chef, and that led to an executive chef at the age of 24. Ultimately, I was in a scenario where the restaurant was going a different direction, and I lost my job. The owner was a chef, and he wanted to get back in the kitchen to save some money, and I was kind of left there. And that's when I decided to look into healthcare. So what brought you from New York to North Carolina? I was in a job for 4 years where I was a chef manager for a 2-hospital system and had a huge success. My wife and I had a 2-year-old son, and we were looking to sell our house there so we could have a better life down here. I was originally investigating the Charlotte area. I'm a member of the Association of Healthcare Food Service, and through collaborating with them, I started to investigate other healthcare organizations that were doing something with food. So I applied for a job at UNC Healthcare in Chapel Hill. That's where I was before I came to Rex. So I spent a little time at UNC. I was a retail manager but got promoted to executive chef. How long have you been here with Rex as an executive chef? I've been here for 6 years and the executive chef for just over 3 years. What's been the biggest hurdle for you since moving over to the healthcare service? Being a chef in healthcare has its obstacles. The healthcare business, you need to be a good leader. At times you are working with people that aren't culinarily experienced, so you have to be a good leader and really teach them. You have to sometimes step away from the cooking and focus on the building and leading a team. Can you tell me a little about the Black Hat Chefs training program? It's an in-house culinary training program between Rex and UNC. We actually invest in the development of our cooks. Over time, our program has developed and we have been able to recruit better quality cooks. They get a formal training of what our standards are, such as knife safety, sanitation, and proper cooking techniques. It would seem there are differences in running a standalone restaurant and a kitchen in a hospital. Would you agree? We are in a hospital, so ultimately we're here for the patients, but we also think of this as a hotel-style operation. We don't let that healthcare stigma affect our creativity. Working in a hospital, are there food restrictions or dietary needs that must come first? We have a team of chefs here, but we have to plan it out a little more because the food has to go through our clinical team of dietitians. If we're going to put something new on the menu, it has to go through a panel first to see if the nutrition information is good. Sometimes we put something out there and our clinical team says, "No, you can't do that because it has too much fat." So then we come back and redesign the recipe to make sure it meets the parameters of the dietitians. So that's on the patient side. How about the retail side of the kitchen? We have free range there. We try to make a lot of diverse dishes because we have such a diverse workforce. We are constantly putting new things out there. During the fire in the Triangle competition, it's safe to say you were an underdog in the competition, but you beat chef after chef and in the end won the competition. How did that make you feel? I'm very proud of what my team has accomplished. After going through the first round, we sat down that night and thought to ourselves, "We think we can take this." The way we looked at it is that we're chefs just like everyone else. Don't let the hospital name think that we can't do this. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the small business page for the In the Workplace column written by Edward Marshall. Marshall works with senior teams and companies to build high trust, collaborative leadership cultures and practices. He is the author of the best-selling Building Trust at the Speed of Change. The headline on this column, How to Combat the Silo Effect and Build Trust. In a certain IT company, business is conducted in silos based on functions and hierarchy. There is a high degree of competence in each silo, but when working across them, there are big gaps. People tend to throw things over the wall, hoping someone on the other side will pick them up. Usually they do, but not always. People in silos don't talk with each other. They communicate through email, even when they are down the hall. Service gaps get created. They don't know each other except by their electronic persona. Politics tends to reign supreme. When people can't get issues resolved, they escalate them to their bosses up the hierarchy. Distrust gets created. This approach to work is time-consuming, inefficient, and slow. For example, the ordering process of R&D equipment in this company was so broken that a cross-functional team of 16 people had to be assembled to fix it. The 16 represented every function along the value chain, but they had never met each other. They'd only heard about each other. After agreeing to some collaborative rules of engagement, they began the current state analysis. It became immediately clear they had no clue as to what the others did or where the breakdowns were. With collaborative ownership and full engagement, they built a high level of trust that enabled them to quickly design the new process, engage their customers, get their buy-in, and implement a customer-driven ordering system that now delivers in 1/4 the time. Collaborative, team-based organizations work. They build high trust, accelerate work, and go from reacting to crisis to preventing them, because people own the work and the business. Here are five dimensions of this approach. Principle-based. The key principle for a high-trust, collaborative organization is ownership. People take care of what they own. They don't wash rented cars. Collaborative and team-based. Collaborative teams are formed to own business functions and processes. They have clear operating agreements, charters, roles, and responsibilities. Take down the silo walls. People have to work across groups to get work done. The silo walls need to disappear so they can. The shift is from horizontal to vertical. Customer-driven. Customers are in the driver's seat around what they need and how they receive it. Business processes are focused on meeting those needs rather than silo wars. Different reward system. The reward structure shifts from individuals trying to please their managers to teams being rewarded for satisfying customers. Siloed hierarchical organizations do not work for the customer or the employee. They focus on power and control, are slow and inefficient, and often create dysfunctional relationships. Collaborative, team-based organizations, on the other hand, focus on building trust and ownership, work horizontally, are results-based and customer-driven, and produce relationships based on trust and mutual respect. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the People on the Move section, where the spotlight is on Laura Gwynn, head of healthcare division at Holt Brothers Construction. Laura Gwynn is coming off a 4-year stint as Director of Ambulatory Facilities Development at WakeMed Health and Hospitals, and before that, she served as an architect at BBH Design. She's now married the two interests, healthcare and architecture, into one with her new post as head of the healthcare division at Holt Brothers Construction. In this role, Gwynn is responsible for business development, project management, hiring, and oversight of the firm's healthcare group. With Laura's background in architecture, her subject matter expertise, and her owner's perspective, we'll be able to bring the art and science of healthcare construction to our clients, says Terrence Holt, president of Holt Brothers Construction. Raleigh-based Holt Brothers Construction is helmed by former NFL players Terrence and Torrey Holt. It currently employs 16 people. What is one thing you wish people knew about your job? how many people it takes to make each vision a reality, and how rewarding it is to build facilities to help improve the health and well-being of our communities. What are some of your major goals in this position? To provide leadership to clients about making sustainable business decisions related to facilities to deal with changes in healthcare and consumer expectations. I also want for Holt Brothers Construction to be a leader in the healthcare construction industry by delivering projects and outreach to improve the health and well-being of our cities, counties, state, and the entire Southeast region, and to create solutions to bridge any gaps in the delivery process, drawing from my experience as an architect and owner's representative to improve project outcomes. Biggest pet peeve? Inaction. Whistling teapots are also near the top of the list. Biggest worry? That people are not doing their life's work. Triangle business person you most admire. One in particular that I admire is the Executive Director of Wake County Economic Development, Adrienne Cole, for her signature, personable style, bubbly spirit, and a passion to grow our area in a meaningful way. Personal, husband Brian, two dogs, Winston and Madison. Last book read, The Motivation Manifesto by Brendan Burchard. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page and the Editor's Notebook. And this is written by Sugathar Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Wake Basks Under Service Sector Jobs. In the business community, ask any CEO or people in charge of their unit's P&L about the financial status of their operations, and they collectively would agree on one thing. Numbers don't lie. On April 15, I received two separate reports on the state of our state and the national economy. One from the Capital Area Workforce Development Board, which tracks jobs and recruiting activity in Wake and Johnston counties, and the other from the National Association of Manufacturers, NAM, detailing the country's manufacturing scene in the first quarter. Interestingly, these reports had very little in common. Understandably so, since Wake and Johnston counties are not exactly the hotbed for manufacturing. But what was startling was our reliance on service jobs to grow the local economy. Mining the help wanted data posted online, the local workforce report concluded that the top eight sectors in the fastest growing area of North Carolina are all in service sectors. Companies in Wake and Johnston counties are looking for software developers, network administrators, web developers, computer system and support analysts, truck drivers, registered nurses, and marketing managers. There are others, but those were the hottest sectors, with each of them claiming more than 1,000 open positions. In all, the two counties posted more than 50,000 open positions in the past 90 days. And that's great, but no one thing. Manufacturing jobs pay more in general. And that brings me to the second report. NAM's first quarter analysis suggests some severe headwinds in the manufacturing sector because of the strong U.S. dollar, lower crude oil prices, and tempered foreign economies. In essence, demand of U.S. goods abroad is waning. But in the U.S., it is the auto industry currently carrying all the strength in manufacturing. March numbers showed auto and auto parts production jumped 3.2%, the biggest among all sectors. While the Greensboro area may see some benefit from a sustained auto economy resurgence, little will be noticed in the Triangle area. But 50,000 job openings in just two counties in the Triangle says a lot about the area's economic activity. The simple fact is more people are working, and they are paying taxes and going to movies, restaurants, sporting activities, and arts festivals. Yes, they are service jobs and probably would be the first to go in the next economic downturn, but we are glad local companies are again hiring. The discussion about wages, however, is a different matter. After all, numbers don't lie. And on the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, there's also a guest column The guest column is written by Donald Bryson, who is the North Carolina Director of Americans for Prosperity in Raleigh. The headline, Let's Reform or Repeal North Carolina's CON Laws. 28 years ago, President Ronald Reagan ended a costly national health care mandate known as Certificate of Need, CON. He declared that this regulation, which forced health care providers to get government approval for new projects and purchases, quote, only served to insert the federal government into a process that is best reserved to the marketplace, unquote. He was right, but North Carolina never got the memo. We still have a CON law on the books. Thankfully, last month, a bipartisan group of North Carolina House members introduced a bill that repeals this requirement for some important health care services. On March 26, a bill was filed in the North Carolina Senate to fully repeal the state's CON laws. This little-known issue has far-reaching effects. CON laws, first created in the 1960s, require health care providers to obtain permission from a state planning board before they add equipment or expand their facilities. Today, 35 states and the District of Columbia still have them. They were intended to keep costs down by preventing a medical arms race between providers. But they accomplished the opposite. By putting bureaucrats in charge of health care decision-making, CON laws have increased health care costs. They have also restricted patient choice. North Carolina has one of the most restrictive CON laws in the nation. Virtually every piece of equipment, even simple hospital beds, can be added only if a healthcare provider obtains a certificate. In practice, this means hospitals and doctors have to lobby the state government for permission to expand. This tilts the playing field against innovative and new healthcare providers. In fact, the U.S. Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission have warned that CON laws essentially create monopolies. The agency say, quote, existing competitors have exploited the CON process to thwart or delay new competition, unquote. The DOJ and FTC also found CON laws impose substantial costs on consumers and healthcare markets. They sure do. Research from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University revealed that CON states have 5% higher costs of healthcare. Mercatus also estimates that there are 67 fewer hospitals in North Carolina and 12,000 fewer hospital beds with a CT scan equipment with CT scan equipment than there would be without the CON requirements. This isn't a surprise. Providers have to jump through time-consuming and expensive hoops to satisfy certificate requirements. Just look at the findings and rulings of the North Carolina Division of Health Service Regulation for the state body that issues certificates of need. You'll find page after page of legalese and formulas compiled by the board in Raleigh just to determine whether a hospital can add a bed or a doctor can add a machine. And these rulings often require a back and forth with Raleigh that takes months or years. They can also cost thousands of dollars in legal fees and dozens of hours of time that could be better spent helping patients. Doctors have enough challenges already as they try to give North Carolinians the medical care we need. They shouldn't be drowned in paperwork, especially when that paperwork itself has a negative impact on the quality of health care. That's why we should applaud state legislators in the House of Representatives, including Charlotte's Dan Bishop, Republican of Mecklenburg, for introducing a bill to reform our CON law. We should also applaud North Carolina Senator Tom Abadaka, Republican of Henderson, for filing a bill seeking to fully repeal North Carolina's CON laws. Either of these bills is a win for North Carolinians. If the General Assembly and Governor Pat McCrory see fit to repeal these laws, our state could have a healthcare system that's more accessible and affordable than it is right now. Anyone who tells you otherwise is only trying to CON you. And also on this page, there are the results of the Business Survey Pulse. The question, do you think the Triangle could support another professional sports team? Number of responses were 772. 55% say yes. 45% say no. And moving back to the news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. RDU moves up in 2014 rankings for passengers freight. Airports Council International's latest report puts Raleigh-Durham International Airport moving up in rankings when it comes to shipping people and packages in-country. RDU gained major traction on the Montreal firm's annual World Airport Rankings, both in terms of domestic traffic and domestic passenger rankings. In 2012, for freight, RDU's rank was 83. Domestic freight, 72,024 metric tons. And passengers, RDU's rank was 90. Domestic passengers, 9,035,900. In 2014, for freight, RDU's rank is 69. Domestic freight, 70,859 metric tons. Passengers, RDU's rank remains at 90. Domestic passengers, 9,272,661. And finally, in a section called Traveler's Choice, we have a look at the 2015 top destinations in the world according to TripAdvisor based on Traveler's reviews. Number one, Marrakech, Morocco. Number two, Siem Reap, Cambodia. Number three, Istanbul, Turkey. Four, Hanoi, Vietnam. Five, Prague, Czech Republic. Six, London, UK. Seven, Rome, Italy. Eight, Buenos Aires, Argentina. Nine, Paris, France. And 10, Cape Town Central, South Africa. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. But be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.